Hi, I'm Abby. I'm a mom and a writer.
Hi, I'm Melanie. I'm a mom and a writer.
Hi, I'm Jenny. I'm a mom and a book coach.
Welcome to Mom Writes, where we aren't slick, we aren't fancy, but we are real. This podcast is all about our coaching journey, writing a book from start to finish. It's real life writing, done at the kitchen table or in our spare 15 minutes between work and school pickup. This is how we get it done. It's the dirty laundry behind writing with kids. If you're interested in more information about Author Accelerator and the same coaching program we use, visit Jenny's website at www.authoraccelerator.com. Welcome back to Mom Writes, where we are celebrating all you writer dads out there with a month of writer dad interviews. We've had Jim Heskett, Dan Blank, and now last but certainly not least, we have Clint Edwards, who I am dubbing a comedic truth teller. Clint is a parenting writer and has written for the New York Times. He's a regular Scary Mommy, and his second book just came out, I'm Sorry, Love Your Husband. If you're married with children, this book is a must read. If you're a mom, it gives you insight into what the other half is thinking. And if you're a dad, it gives you insight into the brain of a man who has figured out, well, some of what's going on in his wife's brain. It's enlightening. Clint's book is like having a fight with your spouse and making up, but without the fight. So you come out of it feeling good about yourself and your marriage because Clint was brave enough to write about it, and his wife Mel was brave enough to let him. So let me warn you, there is swearing in this podcast. It is not suitable for children. So if you are listening in the car with kids in the back seat, don't. Or if you're listening while doing something around the house, throw in your earbuds, because for this episode, we decided that sometimes mommy and daddy, they just have to swear.
We're going to, even though Melanie's not here, we're going to record this part. So Clint and I both like to swear. So here's what I think. This can go on our B-roll at the end. What's your favorite fake curse word to use around the kids? Or in your writing?
In my writing?
Any of it. What's your favorite fake swear word?
Dick face.
But that's a real swear word.
No, that's not a swear word. That's a dick face.
That's a swear word.
That is not a... No. How is dick face a swear word?
Because you couldn't say that to your kid.
I say that to my kid. This is going on the B-roll.
This is the B-roll.
I don't see
Like my favorite swear word is, my favorite fake swear word is Bob Saget.
I think Bob Saget is a more real swear word
than dick face.
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, Bob Saget himself is like a walking swear word, which is what makes it so funny. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Well, he's, you know, he's like this family guy that apparently is very foul in real life.
And yeah, and I think that's super appropriate for parenting.
Sure. I'm going to add Bob Saget, Yeah, I'm going to say that instead. I'm foregoing dick face
for Bob Saget.
Yeah, for Bob Saget.
Oh.
It will totally like, Dad's swearing. And I'm like, I'm fixing the sink, okay? Like, I can fix the sink.
Good morning, Mel. We're talking about how Clint's kids are narcs when it comes to swear words.
You're talking about what now?
Clint's kids are narcs when it comes to swear words. So is Mel's daughter, though. She's
true. She's no fun.
Mel.
Hello,
hi,
Mel.
Clint.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Where is everybody?
I think we're neighbors, Clint. Are you in Oregon?
I am.
And Boise.
Oh, well, I guess it's a similar time zone.
Next door.
Yeah, it's not like I could throw a stone at your yard or something.
Well, most of the people we talk to, at least I talk to, they're on the East Coast. So every time somebody's on the West Coast, I'm like, West is best. So sorry, Abby.
Sorry,
you live in a hot state.
I do. I just moved from Rhode Island to Florida, which is, it's an adjustment, but in a pretty decent way. So
all right.
It's going all right. It's just hot. It's just like hotter than Satan's crotch. Speaking of spare words, that's one of my favorite sayings.
Satan's crotch?
It's hotter than Satan's crotch.
I haven't thought about Satan's crotch.
Ever.
Well, you have today.
I have now. I assume it is warm. I'd like to.
Fiery and also really muggy down there.
Right. Oh, sure. Can you imagine
the shape of Florida really helps with this.
The mental picture?
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like you do a disservice by not pushing record immediately because then we miss all these golden gems. Oh, you did?
No, I already did because I was super afraid we would say something funny because I laughed. I laughed so hard reading the chapter in your book, Clint, that was about touching the turtle that I had to get a box of tissues. And the funny thing was, it wasn't even my husband I was imagining touching the turtle. It was me.
Oh, well, I suppose sometimes things don't go exactly along gender lines. You know, I got a lot of flack when I first published. So that was originally part of it, the turtle touching. So just to keep everybody up to be here, not to give away too much, I went to the Cayman Islands with my wife. And this isn't America, obviously, and there's these big, massive turtles. And you can actually, like, there's nothing stopping you from touching them. And as a good American, I reached out and tried to touch this turtle. And apparently your hand looks a lot like their food. But I'm like, I'm pretty quick, and turtles are pretty slow. So I should be able to touch this turtle and not get my hand. And the turtle, like, flopped its big fin thing and pushed my hand into its mouth. And I felt the inside of its beak. And I jerked my hand back. And I'm like, whoa, he would have eaten my hand. And my wife, Melody, turns around and is like, what did you just do? Did you touch the turtle? And I'm like, look, I'm good. I just showed her my fingers. You know, like, I'm okay. You know, no worries. I'm okay. And this just turned into a big conversation, long kind of dragged out thing while we were in the Cayman Islands that, like, I need to grow up a little. Touch these turtles. Now I'm completely off track. What was your question again?
I don't think we had a question. I think we're I think Mel's only question was, did you hit record so we don't miss any of this?
Yeah. Yeah. So the turtle, it was just, man, I don't know. I was kind of talking about how, like, originally published a section of this in Scary Mommy, and everybody's like, you know, you are kind of feeding into the kind of bumbling dad cliche. And I'm like, well, but sometimes I'm a bumbling dad. Like, sometimes I do kind of that cliche, stupid stuff.
Like, it's cliche, like, for a reason.
Yeah, I guess.
Stereotypes exist for a reason.
We all have fallen into it. I don't think the book as a whole shows me as kind of a bumbling stereotype, but, definitely that moment.
No, I think the book as a whole, I've really enjoyed it. I'm almost to the end because I'm, like, hands down one of the world's slowest readers ever. I read like a sloth. Shame. Would read. Shame. And it's most of the time it's because if I'm enjoying something so much, I don't do that thing where everybody else turns the page and turns the page and turns the page. I don't want to get to the end because then it's over and that makes me sad. And so I'm almost to the end. And so now I'm, like, slow in my roll, Clint, because I'm like, I'm really enjoying this and I want it to go on forever. But there's so many chunks in your book. So for the listeners, because obviously I'll probably record an intro that actually introduces you. Instead, it just jumps right into how our kids are narcs when it comes to swearing. But, you know, there's a lot in the book that the funny thing is I'm identifying from it from the other perspective. And there's a lot of it that I want my husband to read because I think we could all be on the same page if we just read this book.
I think the same thing when I read your stuff, Clint. I'm like, ooh, how can I, like, get my husband to read this so he can, like, understand things from this other perspective? Maybe that's why, I don't know. I feel like there was one article that you did that went super, super viral, and I think it was the one about you getting up in the night with your baby.
Oh, yeah, that was published in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Which makes me, did you hear that? That was published in the New York Times.
Uh-huh. No, actually, before I came down here, my husband's like, where are you going? I was like, I'm going to go downstairs. I'm going to interview a guy who was published in the New York Times.
Oh.
So he's like, well, you better stop standing here then. I'm like, yep. So, but no, I think that that one in particular, at least I know several people talk to me about it, like outside of the realm of this podcast. They're like, did you read this? This is such a good article. And I was like, yes, I did. It's awesome. I think at the time I probably had an infant. And so I was sleep deprived and also a little crazy. Sure. And I just had that like moment of like validation and slight rage. There were a lot of things I reached at as a sleep deprived parent though.
I still have those moments of rage and I don't even feel that sleep deprived anymore. Oh. Mine are sleeping through the night, yet I still rage. So
I think raging is a very big part of being a parent. I think you need to be like one step away from just flipping at all times. It keeps the kids on their toes. Like just the other day we were driving and my 4-year-old was just being a dick face and we're cruising along and my wife just pulled that van to the side of the road and just turned around and that kid felt fear into her 20s. It was awesome. Like, I have never been more impressed with her. I don't know exactly what a trophy wife is, but I know in that moment.
She can scare little children, then yes.
You can scare a 4-year-old into their 20s, like,
so,
that's awesome.
You know, I taught high school before I became a parent, so I had what I felt like was going to be a lot of practice for what was coming down the line, and I was famous. My husband used to love it when I'd rip into some, like, 18-year-old athlete at school who inevitably towered over my 5'2 stature. And I would always start the line with, I'm going to give you two choices. And Sean said he loved it because neither choice was something that the kid would want to pick. And so the other day, Sean came in and what did he say to me? He was mad about something and he looked at me, he said, I'm going to give you two choices. And I said, nope. Because you can't use my line on me. And I just stopped him right there. I was like, whoa, this isn't fair. You can't quote me to me. I was like, doesn't work like that, buddy.
You know, should I tell you all what I actually do for a living? Because I don't write for a living.
No, see, and you know what?
That's good because I assumed that that's what you do.
No,
really?
Do it.
You assumed that? No, no.
I make a lot of assumptions in my day-to-day life that are probably not correct.
I would be on the streets with a very good suntan, no shoes, if I lived off my rack right now. So I actually work with college athletes. So I work at a Division I school, and my job is to tell the students to do their homework. So I am very popular.
I
brought up student athletes.
I love you because I was there just before they got to you, and I'd boss them around. I have made 18-year-old boys, 6'7" basketball players weep just by looking at them.
That's too scary.
That is epic.
When I get hot, I'm like, before I could even say, I'm going to give you two choices. I looked at this kid, I pointed my finger, and he started to cry.
Well, it's a catch-22 with this because, you know, like I get them. In fact, in 1 week, I take all the freshmen and I turn them, you know, I teach them about college and I spend the summer doing a bridge program with them. And they always come up to me and they're like, well, I didn't come here for school. Not all of them, but, you know, the students that I'm struggling with. And they'll be like, yeah, I didn't come here for school. I came here to play ball. You know what I mean? And I'll tell them, I don't care. Like, that's not my job, to turn you into a college student. My job is to get you to earn this degree. And if you stop playing, you never play again. I will still help you. That's not my gig. My job is to turn you into a student. And then they don't like that answer. They don't think that's a good one. But it reminds me of when I was in high school and they'd be like, well, why aren't you, you know, what are you going to do if you don't graduate high school? I'm like, well, I'm going to be in a band.
Yeah,
obviously.
Like, well.
Rockstar is my plan B.
Yeah, I don't. School's like plan D. I got it lined up.
Fame and Learjets, that's plan A.
Yeah, Sean always tells me if being a physicist doesn't work out for him, his plan B is rock god. So,
I know several people that would start a band with him.
College athletics has been interesting because now that I've been in a few years, you know, once I get done working with these students, like anytime a student steps out of line, a coach is just kicking them in the butt. They do these things called 6 a.m.s, and I don't know what they do to them, but whatever they do, like, they don't want them. And they'll come up to me, they're like, Clint, you know, we're friends, right? I'm like, no, we're not. And then they say, well, can you, you know, don't tell my coach I was late. I'm like, I have to. That's just what it is. And then they will come and they can't take the stairs the next morning. I don't know what they do to them.
It sounds painful.
Yeah, they'll never have a boss that hard in their lives. Like, no one has ever been like, geez, Clint, you can show up to work. You got 6 a.m. And they will, but by the end, you know, by their sophomore year, you know, if they don't wash out, like, they just start to look like college students. They just show up to class and they do their biz. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you're just teaching them adulting, which is, like, essentially what every parent's teaching their kid anyway, right? I mean,
if you don't learn it at home, you learn it when you get to college. And if you don't learn it in college,
well, yeah. Bring it back on your parents' couch.
Yeah.
That happens too.
So, you know, it's funny that you say that about you're not making your money doing writing, because at one point, I think you mentioned something about that in your book, like, that there's sort of a guilt. I mean, I feel like some of our listeners, especially the ones who are first-time writers like Melanie and I have never made a penny off our writing. And so we struggle with finding the time and the motivation and not pushing it off to the back burner because it's not making us any money. Sometimes it's hard to prioritize that. And you bring that up in your book that I think, do you say that you and your wife had a conversation about that at one point? Or you...
Yeah, it's in the chapter about how, I think it's the second or third chapter where we got in an argument about making money and how the kids were sick and who's going to stay home with the kids.
That's
and I, like an idiot, said, well, I make more money than you, so you should stay home, which I basically boarded the Titanic and
threw off all the lifeboats.
I was strapped
to the front.
Yep, I was the one clinging to the little door. Like Leonardo. And so she, you know, my wife has a way of, you know, letting me know that I've done, you know, that I need to straighten out. I need to figure it out. It took us years to get here, but she's pretty willing to tell me now. And yeah, I mean, I was actually working on the book, and that was when Mel had started working. She works as a teacher and at an elementary school, my kid's elementary school. And we just had to have it out. And I ended up apologizing because it's not really about money. It really should be about passion and interest in what you're doing. And I mean, geez, I made zero money writing for a long time. I mean, even now I make like decent part-time income. It's hard to make money writing. And the people that do, I don't know who they are. I don't know how they do it. But it has become one of those things where now that I'm starting to make money, it's kind of like gone to my head, you know, at least in that moment. But geez, there was, you know, I mean, it was over a decade of me just getting up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, pounding away on the keyboard to no one. Mm-hmm. So if you're getting into writing for money,
don't.
Well, I mean, you know, what I can say is writing has always been very good for me to think about my family and my father. I used to write a lot about my father and his drug addiction and different stuff. And it's helped me kind of make sense of it. But the best thing I ever did for my marriage and for my children is about writing. Because it just helps me make sense of it. It helps me. There are times that I have written an essay about something. I'm like, I wonder why that's bothering me. And I'm like, oh, I was being a dick. And then I will go apologize to my wife. And then I'm able to finish the essay.
It's like free therapy that you give yourself.
Something like that. Sure. Yeah. That's what it is. I'm just saving money on therapy. Yeah.
So, I mean, and you write about a lot of things that I'm like, wow, he actually put that down on paper and let other people read it. I'm like, good for him. I won't lie. The part about the skid marks in your underwear, I was like, way to go, Clint, for
well, there's that same chapter. There's the boogers under the car
seat. Boogers under the seat.
Yeah, the front seat. And I have gotten numerous texts about that from like friends, and they'll just send me like a quote or like a picture from that page with a bunch of laughing emojis. I don't feel like that does not make me embarrassed. I don't feel embarrassment in that regard. And I don't know why. There's, I guess it's a blessing. I don't know. But that doesn't, well, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, we got boogers, you know what I mean? You got to do stuff with them. And so I did send, but my wife does read everything that goes out. We have the mail edit. And she reads everything, and there are things that did not make the cut, I assure you. It's out her little red pen, and she's like, nah, nah, nah.
Take it out. Because my husband did pick up your book, and he sort of flipped through it before he left. He had to leave this week and go away for work. And he said to me, wow, this guy talks about his sex life in the book. He's like, you're not allowed to talk about that on the podcast. And I was like, okay. Don't worry. I'm like, Melanie and I have this thing where we're like, we can't write about boobs. We can't do it. No writing about boobs. So
hey, I wrote about a boob.
Yeah, so Jenny made you take the word boob out and change it to breast.
I didn't say boob.
She said we were adults.
You didn't say
boob. The word.
No. We're gonna argue say about boob? This all day. No, I didn't. Does that in literature, really?
I don't talk about the act of sex. There's none of that. It's just, you know, that sex happens. I did talk about my vasectomy, which was enlightening, I think, for those trying to not get one, which is common.
I haven't done that yet. I'm not going to until my husband gets his, so.
Oh, well, it might help him. It wasn't that bad. Other than all the people staring at me with no pants on. Other than that.
That was the worst part.
That was the worst part. There's like three people in the room just talking about your balls. He just kind of got me like, yep, give me another Valium.
I am fine with this.
Yeah.
But I like the way that you take your life. I mean, which, let's face it, there's so much in the book that I feel like we all relate to in some way or another. And sure. You're able to take it and write about it. And like you said, not only are you processing it for yourself and strengthening your own marriage, but now I'm like, oh my God, I just read this book. My husband's got to read this book. So we're all on the same page, because there are quite a bit of universal truths, I think, in what you've written. And I appreciate that. And so, you know, I don't really know where the question is in this, except that I feel like I'm just throwing that out there because it was fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you. I would say that there isn't, I don't know. I think so much of this book was just me trying to, I mean, of course, I want to make money as a writer and stuff like that. But like we said, like it's kind of hard to do. So a lot of it was just, I mean, so much of it's just, I mean, I really love my wife. Like I genuinely love her. But I don't get her. Like there are so many times that like we will be cruising along. I'm like, man, I am so lost right now. Or she'll get mad at me. I'm like, I don't know what I did. And I know once again, we're kind of falling into that cliche kind of stereotype stuff, but we are very different people. And same with my kids, my wife and my kids, like every time I think I figured them out, they change. Mm-hmm. And writing about it and trying to answer those questions for myself has been really helpful. And I know that makes it sound like, well, geez, Clint, why don't you just write it down and keep it to yourself? But I think, it is good to help other people. And I think, and I've been getting a lot of messages from people that are like, we read this out loud to each other on a road trip. And we had these great conversations about our marriage, or it really helped us out. But I guess kind of the, where it's complex is like, it seems like a lot of women are reading it and then they're trying to get their husbands to read it and not getting that to work. So what they'll do is they'll highlight chapters and be like, you're reading this.
Just this one.
No.
Just this one. Please read the one about the dot, so we can get through this.
That tactic probably doesn't work very well.
I don't know. I know it's happening. I know. I don't know the end result.
There's a bunch of husbands out there that are kind of pissed at this Clint Edwards guy because he's like,
there was a point where I was the number one new release, fatherhood new release on Amazon. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm probably the number one most hated father on other fathers. I don't think they have a flag for that, but no, actually we joke about that, but I think most men that read it aren't ticked. I don't get a lot of hate mail other than that are, I mean, usually like if I get a troll, which I do, and generally it's like a man with like an American flag somewhere in his profile picture and a handlebar mustache or something. It's very, speaking of cliches. And I will always offer them, I used to get like block them or I get arguments with them and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to kill them with kindness. And so I just say, hey, I want to give you a copy of my book. I'm going to send you a copy of my book because you need this more than anybody. You are my target audience. And I've done this for a long time because I have, you know, my earlier book that I wrote and I've had two people now actually take up my gracious offer. One man even apologized. So we're really, I mean, out of the hundreds,
you're making strides.
It's not so good, but if I can help, I mean, to get a troll to come out and send you a message and say, hey man, I'm sorry, I've been a jerk. feels pretty good for an online writer.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Making connections with readers is important, even if they hate you at first and they come to love you. So,
sure.
No, but I think the reason why people relate to it as much as they do is, I mean, parenting can be kind of isolating, especially modern parenting, you know? I mean, they say it takes a village or whatever, but I know several people who, you know, they have to pack up and move somewhere they've never lived before. They have two or three kids and it's just them. There's no support system.
No parents.
It's just them together trying to make it work. And even if you do have a support system, it's hard. So I don't
Not
know.
Just
I
think that. It's good. Everybody judges.
Yes, everybody judges.
Yeah.
People are super judgmental. So.
I mean, we're all winging this.
Yeah.
Like, we're all figuring this out as we go. Like, there's no.
And like you said, as soon as you figure it out, they throw you a curveball.
Yeah.
I mean. Mm-hmm. Because they just grow up to the next stage of mayhem. And then you have to figure that out.
I got in the car yesterday. Out of nowhere, I was starting the car and leaving the garage. My daughter's like, do you believe in a higher power? She's 7, by the way. And I was like, where did that come from? She's like, I've been doing a lot of thinking lately. I was like, clearly, okay. But, you know, just like out of nowhere, or we'll be laying in bed at night and she'll be like, our house is going to burn down, isn't it? I was like, oh my God, okay.
Deep Thoughts by Evie Parrish.
Deep Thoughts by Evie, yeah.
Oh, I know.
You're doing that.
It was like 2 days ago, like we got this dog who I've got mixed feelings about the dog, but that's a different story. But he gets randy and he starts going at it with his dog bed and which has been neutered. So I don't understand how that all works, but I'm just sitting, like my son comes up to me out of nowhere and he's like, hey dad, the dog's got this like massive boner and I'm kind of afraid of it. I'm like, just don't touch it. You'll be fine. And then my daughter, who's 7 or 8, I think she's 8. Anyways, she comes in and she's like, hey, you know, yeah, what do we do with, you know, the dad's, well, she called it his butt lipstick or something. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes when guys get excited, you know, they get big down there. And so suddenly I'm talking about like puberty and boners. And it was just like, boom, out of nowhere. You just don't know when it's gonna shoot up on you. And she's like, man, guys are weird. And I'm like, yeah, tell me about it. I've been living with this thing for a while.
So Mel, you know what I think we need to tell him is the chicken story.
The chicken story?
So Clint, we've had a whole bunch of discussions in my family with the girls. My girls are 6 and 8 about barnyard sex because we bought a hobby farm in Florida. And there are a lot of animals, and we had chickens in Rhode Island, but now we have chickens. We have roosters. We never had roosters before. And so
I've never had roosters.
A lot of
them. You're going to have to teach me a little bit about roosters here as we go.
So
they
boink in the yard all the time. I mean, they climb on top of each other and they go at it. And the girls have had all sorts of questions that have included things like, well, do they kiss first? And I'm like, I don't know how you would kiss with beaks. So they don't touch their beaks. I'm like, I think they skip that part, you know? It's, well, how do you know that the chicken wants to do it. And I'm like, I don't know if there's consent in a barnyard.
There's no
there's
consent
a lot.
In the barnyard.
No consent, no foreplay.
Anyway, my kids have been bringing the eggs inside and using the flashlight on my phone to look inside the eggs. You can see the little hearts beat. And so you know if the egg has been fertilized or not. And so we talked about the word fertilized. So the other day we go out in the yard. Well, they've named the rooster Coach Sean after their basketball coach because the roosters tell everybody what to do just like a basketball coach. So Coach Sean the rooster was mounting their favorite chicken in the yard, and my six-year-old walks up and with one arm just whacks that rooster off and yells, "Coach Sean, why you gotta fertilize everybody in this yard?" And I'm like, "Stop it! Please don't go to school and repeat this story," is all I could think. Coach Sean was fertilizing people in the yard. I'm like, no.
It's okay, that coach is like 2,000 miles away now. So.
Oh no, I called him and told him because I thought it was kind of funny.
Sure.
I'm sure he appreciated that, the honor of the rooster being named after him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I mean, someone wants to name a rooster after me, you know, that sounds okay.
Well,
I was like, sure.
We got two. Should we name the other one Clint?
You know, you would throw the idea out there. You know,
I'll see if it sticks.
I think that we have to now, Abby. I'm godparent of all of Abby's animals since I live so far away, and I want a hobby farm, and I can't have one because my HOA doesn't allow it. I'm godparent to all of Abby's animals. Yep.
No pigs in your neighborhood.
I have no desire to have. My wife wants to get chickens, and I'm like, why? Like, we can go to the store and we can buy eggs. Like, we're good.
It's a pet that gives you food.
I mean, that's great. You know, like spiders can like poop out their own home and stalk it. Like, that doesn't mean I got spiders around. Okay. Like, I'm not interested in having something else to care for. I got three kids and a cat and a dog. All right. I'm already like knee deep in poop.
And the dog, your jury's still out on the dog.
Well, here's the thing with the dog. Okay. So he was mainly we got him because my son was afraid of dogs, right? And he was getting bad. Like, he wouldn't go out into the neighborhood because he was afraid he'd see a dog. And I don't know where the phobia came from, but I'm like, all right, talk to some people. And I'm like, you're just going to have to get a dog. Like, that's probably the easiest way to handle it. Mm-hmm. So we get this little dog. I go with a pound and we got a rescue dog, which made me feel really good inside. But rescue dogs often come with emotional baggage, right? And so this particular dog, I don't know, his name is Pikachu, right? Which I don't like Pokemon, I don't like dogs. So of course this all works out perfectly as a father.
It's win-win.
And, yes. And so he, he's like a, he's just a little guy. He's like a Dachshund. Is that how you say it?
Dachshund?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. And then he's like a Chihuahua mix. He's a Chiweenie. Perfect. So for the sake of this story, he is a Chiweenie, and he is whoever had him before, obviously the man was very abusive to him. So if I raise my voice at all, his reaction is to lay on his back and pee in the air. Although his name is Pikachu, I'm thinking we should have named him Squirtle or something because to be problem. Like, I will yell upstairs, like, "We're running late, guys. Get down." Dog pees up in the air. If I approach him and like try and pick him up, pees in the air. There was a point where like I was trying to bring our cat through the house into the garage so he could get some food, and the dog jumped up to try and bite the cat. And so I'm holding the cat up and he's scratching at my arm and making me bleed. So I yell at the dog to stop. And he lays on the ground and pees up in the air onto me. So I'm bleeding and I got dog pee on me. And I'm wondering what I got into all this for. And I have empathy for the dog. Like, I feel sorry for him. But at the same time, he's laying on his back and peeing in the air.
Is your son still afraid of dogs?
No, he's over it. But apparently these dogs live for like 12 to 15 years. So I don't know what to do. Like, I posted about this on my blog. People are like, "Well, get him dog diapers." I'm like, "Great, I'm back in diapers. I just got out of
teepee."
Yeah. And then, oh, sure, PPTP. I'll
just drop one of those on there every time he turns on his back. Stay still. Hold on. Don't
just
pee.
Keep them in your pocket. So when you feel the urge to yell, you pull out the PPTP first and then you're prepared.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, some people were saying cannabis oil. And I'm like, is that for me or the dog? Because apparently, yeah, both. Apparently,
both. You're in Oregon.
Yeah, he needs therapy of some kind. I'm going to need therapy.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Good one. Nice.
I'm going to need therapy with this dog. I wanted to get rid of him at one point, as if I even know how to get rid of him. I don't even know what that means. You know what I mean? Take him back. I don't know if they have a return policy. I don't know. We've had him for almost a year, and the kids adore him. Like, they love the dog. So I'm stuck with the dog. And I'm going to have to figure out some way to just keep him from peeing up in the air. Nervous.
So this is going to be your next, this is going to be in your next book then, right?
I hope there's a resolve that I can put this into a nice.
Because it's a pretty good story.
It is.
A little update in the next book. The dog still pees everywhere. Still don't like the dog. The end.
Heads up.
So what are you working on next?
I don't know. That's a good question. Thank you for making me feel unaccomplished. I get asked that a lot. I'm a staff writer for Scary Mommy, so I'm always writing there. I'm always writing on my blog. I started writing, I write once a month for A+, which is like Chicken Soup for the Souls mm-hmm. website. And so I'm always working, but I don't know what the next book is. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things, like my last book came out a month ago. And I've got to sell enough books to get a book deal and to get another book deal, I would assume, anyways. So I don't know. I would like to write another collection of parenting essays. I think that'd be good. I wouldn't even mind doing like a YA novel. That's kind of
I was about to ask if you had ever thought about writing fiction, but I thought, no, suppress that question because you're just trying to bring him over to your side. I write MG, which I love. And I think that when you come from a perspective like ours, parenting in education, that there's so much you can draw from to write for, you know, especially with the age that you teach, writing YA makes perfect sense because you understand that voice. And I just think it's been immensely helpful for me in my fiction writing to draw on my actual real life experiences, which you've done, you know, for your parenting essays, but I would think you would be a natural at it.
Well, we're going to find out, maybe. I don't know. I'd love to. So, you know, at one point I wrote this grand literary memoir, you know, cause I have an MFA and I published in, you know, different, you know, outlets and, you know, different universities where nobody read. And before I started blogging, and I still have that around. And a lot of it takes place, you know, in high school. And I think I could turn that into why, at least that's what I'm thinking. But I don't know. I honestly don't know what the next step is. And that sounds terribly anticlimactic. So I'm sorry.
No, actually, it's just real. So thank you for sharing it, not making up some bullshit.
Oh, sure. I could. Yeah. We could
no, with, it's better just to lay the truth out there.
Lay it all out there.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Writing is just hard.
Well, I don't know if this will make anybody feel better or disheartened, but I mean, I've literally, by this point, I have been rejected by thousands of agents and editors and publishers, small publishers, independent publishers. Part of the reason I self-published the first book, because I just couldn't get through the gate. It took a lot. And until I met up with this press, Page Street, that published my book, and they're distributed by Macmillan, which is great. It's cool to be in bookstores, but they're still like kind of a small independent press. I enjoy working with them. But it was interesting because I sent them like a query letter and they called me, which was, I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, let's talk on the phone. That's great. You're like real people. And we talked for like an hour and they were like, we think that we like your writing and we enjoy your following. We think that's all good. But, you know, your concept for a book sucks. So we want to talk about creating a new concept. And that's where we came up with this book of apologies. And if I learned anything from that moment is that I almost ended up with essentially the same book I pitched to them. It was just in a better package. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that makes a big difference, at least for me, was finding the right package. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fantastic. That's fantastic advice, too, to share, is to be open to, because it seems like so many people, especially after you've worked on something for so long, you're so married to it that it's difficult to want to change anything about it when ultimately if you just, I mean, it's words on a page. What's it take to save a copy and just try it? And
yeah.
So,
yeah, it's hard though. I mean, you spend, you know, months or even years on something and then somebody's like, actually, yeah, my idea is better. And they're right because this is what they do for a living. And even though writing is what you do for a living, selling books is what they do for a living. So.
Well, I know. So to put this into perspective, you know, I studied writing as an undergrad. And I remember when I first got into like a workshop, I remember getting comments from the professor. I was like, man, those are harsh. You know, that was mean. And then, but then I learned from them. And then I went to graduate school. And then I was like, man, they had the kid gloves on when we were in undergrad because these are pretty rough, right? And then I turned in my first full draft of the book. And I'm like, this is awesome. I did it. I'm doing great. I ate an entire pizza. And it was really good. And then like 2 or 3 weeks later, it wasn't very long. The editor came back with 10 single spaced pages of comments per section. And I'm like, did you hate the book? She's like, no, it's a good book. These are just the things that need to change. And I was mad. I was like really mad at her. And I'm like, what does she know? And then I ate an entire other pizza for a very different reason. And then I worked through that book for another several months. And then that's what we ended up with. But once it was done, I ended up writing the way that I had wanted to write when I started writing. And that was awesome. But the getting there was rough, I'll be honest.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's important to remember, I don't know what people think when they pick up a book in the bookstore, if they think that you just lock yourself in a room for several months and pound out this perfect manuscript. That's, you know, that's not how it works. Nobody ends up doing it alone. So,
no,
you know,
I had a professor in college who was kind of a dick face, but he did give me a very good story at one point. He said that he went to a dentist once and the dentist was like, oh, you teach writing. You know, I've been thinking about taking a summer off and just writing a novel. And he said, oh, that's cool. I was thinking of taking a summer off and becoming a dentist. And which is totally him. That's just the way he does things. But that's really true. It took me years to get here. Now, don't get me wrong. There are people that just squat down and poop out, you know, a beautiful piece of work. And with, you know, like you've been hearing a lot about Anthony Bourdain, which is completely tragic, but I was listening to an interview and he said, yeah, I just wrote this one essay and published it. Never really written before. And then got a book deal. And then it was New York Times bestseller. And so when people tell me the muse isn't there, I think they're obviously incorrect. I think that there are obviously people that are kind of born with the muse, but the greater majority of us just have to sit there super early in the morning, right into the sunset. Yeah.
Is that what you do? Is that when you write super early in the morning?
Yeah. I mean, it's getting more complicated. I used to always get up at like 5:30. I try to write 2 hours a day and I've done that for over a decade, I guess. It's been a long time. But now that Mel's working and the kids are getting older, it's getting harder. So sometimes I get up before them and write a little bit and then go get to help get them ready for school and then come in and write. But for the most part, I come in as early as I can. I try and find that I have a lot of little hiding spots. I mean, writing is cramming. It's cramming writing into the margins of your life. No one's ever going to come up to you and be like, whoa, did you write today? Maybe you should take a little time and get your writing done. Like nobody cares. I write first thing in the morning. I know people that write well into the night. It kind of depends on, you got to figure that groove out. I write a lot on my phone. I have been known to like have my 4-year-old like claw at me for a popsicle and I will run into the bathroom and lock the door, you know, and write. And she's like banging on it like a SWAT team or something. And I'm just like, just tuning her out and typing it. But I honestly think I'm getting like carpal tunnel in one of my thumbs because I write so much on my phone. But you just have to just find places. I mean, I've written on lunch breaks and I've written on buses and I've written on planes and I've, you know, wherever I can. And my wife is very supportive of it. It took us a while to get here, but it is to the point where like, if I look like I'm writing, I can just kind of put my hand up and she'll be like, she'll come back with the question later.
Yeah. That's good.
We've kind of hit our our time limit for snack size podcast, Mel, like we've been talking about. We're trying to make ourselves a little more snack sized because ain't nobody got time for that, we decided. So if you can't listen to it in the car on the way to school pickup, it's probably too long. So, yeah. But I'm so glad that you came today.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, I am thrilled that you had me on. Thank you. This has been a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot about farming. So
I can teach you so many more things, too. We didn't even talk about the pigs.
That's what this podcast is really about. It's about small-time farming and a little bit of writing.
Yeah. It's going to be Charlotte's Web up in here. So anyway.
So Clint will be coming back on the show, if for no other reason than I enjoyed talking to him so much that I will manufacture a reason to talk to him again. So look for Clint around back to school time, as I am sure by the end of the summer, we will all have discovered lots of new parenting nuggets to share. I'm pretty sure we're all going to be happy to see that big yellow bus roll its way through the neighborhood once again, because when it does, we can all get back down to business as usual when it comes to our writing.